Okay, I guess we can get underway. Welcome to the face-to-face version of Mini Algebra. So I just assigned homework set 2 off the line. Some of you may have seen it. I forgot to do it. So what I've done is I just made the due date a week from today in class. But Well, we may have opportunities later this week to go through some of the problems in the weather. Maybe I'll start, since this is my first time seeing you guys face to face, ask if there are any questions or not so much. Okay, so what we're going to do today is we spent the first 2 weeks developing the calculational tools that we'll be using throughout the course. And now we're now making a transition to things we can actually do with these tools. And the first thing we're going to do is learn how to solve equations. But before I start that, let me just review very quickly what went on in lecture last week, where in the second week of class, what we did is, first week of class, we talked about vectors and vector spaces. The second week of class was largely developed to understanding what matrices are and how to manipulate them. That's what I'm going to review to start. And then we'll turn to a really first application of all the apparatus and how to solve large systems of linear equations. Okay, so let me firstly, I'll remind you about matrix multiplications. So what are matrices? Let me get up. By matrix, of course, what I mean is some rectangular arrangement, A12, A1M, maybe the F written three of the M elements, the first row of this matrix, and then second row, the A21, A22, similar terms, A22M, and then similar rows until we get to the last row, A and M. And this is what we would call N by M matrix because it has N rows and N columns. And notice, as is typical in this course, the convention back throughout mathematics, is the first index here on these entries refers to which row it lives in, and the second entry always refers to which column it lives in. All right, so that's going to be important because when we define matrix multiplication, we have to pay attention to rows and columns in the various factors. All right, so the first matrix has the number of its columns is not equal to the second. Oh, I hope. Okay, well, let me go back here. Okay, so unless there's a proper number of columns in the first factor, why have they have to be equal to the rows in the second factor? The product is just not defined, and it's useless to us mathematically. However, going up very well. Okay. On the other hand, as long as the number of columns in the first factor equals the number, then we can compute a bunch of numbers. The rows are going to have the same dimensions of the columns of A are going to have exactly the same, the rows of A are going to have exactly the same dimension as the columns of B. And so we can take the dot product. Writing down the individual elements in the row, well, there's going to be, in any particular row, there's going to be a fixed number of columns, A. And in any particular column, B, now you're going down the rows, the number of these guys is equal to the number of entries in a given column is equal to the number of rows of B. So you need those dimensions to match up so that this dot product is defined. But so long as that dot product fine, you can get an entry for each choice of a row of A and each choice of a row of a column of B. fact, that's exactly how we compute the matrix product. Let me do a quick example on the board. That formula is not very hard at all to implement, and in fact, what you should be good at, maybe by the end of this week or after you do the homework, is to do most of the calculation in your head. Suppose we have 2, 1, 1, 0, 1, 2. And I have three columns here. So I'll need something with at least three rows here for that product to be fine. So let's take 1, 2, 1, 0, 2, 2. Okay, now, the quick way to do this product, and it is defined because this is a matrix with two rows and three columns, multiplying a matrix with three rows and two columns, this is the necessary match you need. Because those inner dimensions match up, the product is defined. And what's going to get kicked out? Well, that's going to be determined by these outer dimensions. This is going to go to a 2 by 2 matrix. This number goes there, and that number goes there. So, just looking at the dimensions of these matrices, I can detect whether the product is defined, and in fact, I can even predict the size of the matrix that's going to be produced. All right, so let's calculate it. I need to take to get this entry in the first slot, first row, and first column of the product. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the first row of the first factor and take its dot product with the first column of the second factor. So I have 2 plus 2 plus 1. All right, now I hope you're seeing what I'm doing. I'm putting my fingers on the two numbers I'm looking at and I'm multiplying them together. 2 times 1 is 2. And then I add to that 1 times 2, that's 2. And then I add to that the last component times the last component, 1. All right, and let's see. Then I have another column I could dot this first row with. I can dot it with the second column. And that's going to give me the entry in this corner. So I have 2 times 0, which is 0, 1 times 2, which is 2, and 1 times 2. Now I have a second row from the first matrix that I can use to compute some more dot products. First, I'll take a dot product of the second row with the first column. That's going to give me second row, so I'll be in the second row in the product, and I'll also be in the first column. So I have 0 plus 2 plus 2. And then I have one last column to work with. I have 0 plus 2 plus 2. So it looks like this matrix upon evaluation just works out to be 5, 4, 4, 4. Okay, so there's a computation of a matrix product of a 2 by 3 matrix with a 3 by 2 matrix. Okay, so you need to understand that the rules for multiplication, but in fact, we're not going to spend too much time multiplying matrices in this course. Nevertheless, it's really important to understand how to carry out this calculation. It is tedious because you end up taking a whole bunch of different dot products to completely fill a matrix. So, for example, if I wanted to multiply together 2 3 by 3 matrices, there's 9 different inner products I'm going to have to compute just to fill in the entries of the result. But all always design problems were most. Even though these could be any real numbers, I usually design problems so that you're working with integers and so that arithmetic is not going to be hard at all. You just have to understand the rule. You just have to understand how to implement this rule. Okay, so that's matrix multiplication. Another thing we brought out last week is there's a particular matrix, the so-called identity matrix. That's the square matrix. It's going to have the same number of rows as it has columns. And its form is it's like this. You have ones along this diagonal from the upper left to the lower right, but everywhere else in that matrix, you have nothing but zero. And it's called the identity matrix because it has this nice property. If you multiply any matrix by the identity matrix, So long as the product itself is defined. What does that mean? Well, for this product to be defined, the number of columns of the first vector has to equal the number of columns of the second, a number of rows of the second vector. But so long as that's true, I times A is going to equal A, and the opposite multiplication in the opposite order is still going to equal A. Okay, so it behaves like the number one. And then, let's see, there were two other operations that are analogous to our notions of scalar multiplication and vector addition. And instead of applying them to vectors, we can apply similar rules to matrices. So for example, I can add two matrices together as long as they have the same size. Just like I can add vectors together as long as they have the same dimension. And the rule is that you simply add the component in the, to get the component in the ij slot of the sum, you just add the component, the same component in the individual sum. And we have scalar multiplication, wherein if you have a matrix and you can multiply it by a number, and all that means is that every entry in the matrix gets modified by the same factor. You choose a number lambda, and then you multiply every entry of the original matrix by that number to get the scalar multiple matrix A by the number lambda. Okay, so that's pretty easy. This last one, I don't think I actually managed to cover very well in Friday's lecture, but there's another operation we can do to matrices that will be useful down the road, and that is, well, we form matrices by either writing down a list of rows or writing across a list of columns. But we can always convert the rows of a matrix into columns of another matrix. And in fact, that operation is called taking the transpose. Let me give you a quick example. I have 2, 3, 1, 1, 1, 1, I can compute its transpose. Well, I can try to write down the individual entries using this formula, but more simply, what you do is you look at the rows and you convert them into columns.
Sir, can you please turn it to the left? I cannot see you on the other side.
But I'm not going to be doing this very often. What I did is I took this first row and I wrote it as a column. I take the second row and I write that as a column. And then this matrix, which is now a 3x2 matrix, is the transpose of this original 2x3 matrix. Okay. So that's the transpose, and just some properties of the transpose. If you do the transpose twice, naturally you get back what you started off with. What you would do is you would take, so here I take a transpose once, but if I do that operation again, what happens? Well, this column is going to get converted into this first column becomes the first row. And so we get 2, 1, and the second column becomes the second row. And so if I apply the transpose operation twice, I get back to where I started. And let's see, we have transpose is not affected by scalar multiplication, nor is it really affected by add two matrices before taking the transpose, and we would get the same result as if we took the transpose of the matrices first and then added them. And then lastly, and this is the strange rule about taking transposes. When you have a product of matrices and you take its transpose, what in fact happens is you get the product of the transpose, but they written in the reverse order. Well, that's important. suppose effectively reverses the order of multiplication. Okay, but the applications of the transpose operation actually, we're not going to see those for a bit later, so I'm going to now skip over this stuff, which all to be covered in Friday's lecture, and now we'll start fresh with a new topic, which is solving systems of equations. Okay, so recall that the original way I introduced matrices was by giving you a set of equations and saying I can extract the data that's used to establish the set of equations, and I can combine them into sort of data objects that we would call matrices. In fact, as long as I can take all these coefficients, collect them together in one rectangular array. And in fact, I'm pretty much able to get this array by simply erasing everything on this side of the equation, erasing all the variables, you know, plus signs, etc. That gives me directly the matrix of coefficients corresponding to this system of equations. The variables, x1 through xm, I can plug those into another matrix, but this is a matrix with n rows in a single column. And then here, I've taken all the numbers that appear on the right-hand side, and I've arranged those in another matrix. So each of these objects is a matrix. And in fact, the left-hand side here is to be interpreted as the product of this column matrix by this rectangular matrix. So let me show you real quickly this translation. Let's see. Suppose we have qx1 plus x2 is equal to 1 and minus x1 plus x2 is equal to 2. Okay, so that's it. Two equations, two unknowns. And so what we're going to call a 2x2 linear system. So that's reflecting the language of matrices, and indeed, from this linear system, I can write down associated matrices. The coefficient matrix, I get that by grabbing the multipliers of each of the variables in each equation. So the first equation, I have 2 times the first variable, 1 times the second variable. The coefficient matrix, and then the second equation, what's multiplying x1 is minus 1, and what's multiplying x2 is again 1. So there's the coefficient matrix. Let's write the variables right next to it, x1 and x2, and let's collect the numbers that appear on the right-hand side, 1, 2. All right, now what I've got is a matrix equation, right? Product of these matrices should equal this matrix. What does that have to do with the original system of equations? Well, when you compute that product, you get 2 times x1 plus x2. So the dot product of this first row, this first column, is going to be 2x1 plus x2. Dot product of the second row with that column is going to be minus x1 plus x2. And we're not doing anything to the right-hand side. We get this. But now notice that when we compare both sides of the equation, component by component, these matrices are said to be equal, so each component has to be equal, and we just recover the original linear system. All right, so what you should understand from this is that what I'm doing is I'm taking a large linear system, and I'm able to encapsulate it in a single equation, just takes three letters to actually write down the equation rather than all this writing. Although each of these boldface letters actually represent a matrix. But as long as you know what those matrices are, the matrix equation exactly replicates the original linear system. And what we're going to do in linear algebra is not solve these linear systems as you would in high school by maybe solving for one variable, substituting into another equation, you eliminate another variable, etc. Rather than following that process of solving for a variable and substituting into subsequent equations, we're going to develop a general technique that works with these matrices. And you don't have to, in fact, we'll pretty much ignore the variables throughout the calculation when all is said and done. Okay, so that's where we're headed. It's a formulation of the solution of large systems of equations via a matrix formulation. But before we actually implement that, what I want to do to start is simply build some intuition as what it actually means to solve a system of linear equations. And here I'm going to focus on the geometric interpretation. So you can, rather than dealing with order and range of numbers, you can actually visualize what's going on a little bit. Okay, so again, an equation is linear if the variables that appear in it are all separated into separate terms, and any individual term of the equation is either a number times a variable, or number times a single variable, or just a pure number. We move all the pure numbers to the right-hand side, keep the variable term on the left-hand side. Then we have multiple equations. We just compile them on top of one another until we generate a system. N by N linear system is a system of N linear equations in a total of M unknowns. All right, so what I want to talk about is what are the solution sets look like? And let's look at the easiest case, the trivial case, where we don't impose any equations on M variables. Well, if we're not imposing any conditions on those variables, they're completely free. And so, solution set of no equations in M unknowns is just going to be the variables of which there are M are free to range over the entire real line. And so what you get as a solution set is simply every ordered list of M numbers. These numbers are arbitrary, and as soon as we write them as a column vector, effectively we've got an ordered list of numbers, an ordered list of M numbers. So it's just, you just get back, effectively the vector space of variables, but without any conditions. All right, so let's go to the first entropy case. Suppose we impose a single equation. All right, so here it is. And I'm not putting double subscripts on these coefficients because in this instance, there's only one equation. But what we can do, say, if this is a non-trivial equation, something other than zero is equal to zero, then at least one of these coefficients has to be non-zero. So we have a non-zero term on the right-hand side. Let's just assume that that non-zero term is, well, at least the last term is non-zero. So AM is not equal to zero. The reason for this assumption is that as long as AM is not equal to zero, I can solve this equation for the variable XM. Right? So you take all the terms but the last one, and you move it to the opposite side, and then to isolate the variable itself, you divide that sum by the coefficient AM. And so solving this equation for this last variable XM tells you that that last variable is B divided by AM minus A1 divided by M plus X1, etc. All right, so that's how you solve in high school one equation in M unknown. What I wanted to show you is how to interpret that solution geometrically. So, let's first of all write that solution as a vector. Now, the solution, the only thing that this equation really implies is that the last component can be expressed in terms of the preceding component, x, or the preceding variable, x1 through xn minus y. So what I'll do to write a solution vector down, these variables, except for the last variable, are unrestricted by the equation. We use the equation just to determine the last variable xn. And so I'll substitute into the general vector this particular form. My only have to change the last entry. I change the last entry, so it's exactly the solution of the equation. Right. And then I could do some vector algebra. And so what have I done? So if you look at this vector, some terms are proportional to variables. Some terms are independent of variables. And in fact, some terms are proportional to x1, some terms are proportional to x2, some terms are proportional to xn minus 1. What I'm doing in this between these two lines is I'm taking that sum and I'm splitting it apart. The constant terms, I'm grabbing those all in one vector. So there's no constant there, no constant there, no constant until I reach this last entry. Here's a constant. So let me just grab that guy and put it in a single vector and put zeros everywhere above it because there's no constants above it. Then I have terms that are proportional to x1. Well, in these middle lines here, there's no x1. So I'm going to get nothing but zeros for the contribution of x1 in those entries. But I do have an entry up here, and I have an entry down here that involves x1. So I write it down. Then I proceed to look at, well, how does x2 occur? And it'll occur here, and it'll occur in this next term that I did not write down on the slide. You can keep doing that until you reach the last variable, xn. It appears in the penultimate term, the second to the last term, and it also appears in the last term. So I hit those two terms in. All right, so what I've done is I've taken my solution vector and I've ripped it apart. And now the next step is to realize that each of these terms past the first one, this one, every component of this vector is proportional to x1. Even zero is zero times x1. And similarly, the second vector that I did not write down, would only every term would be multiplied by x2. The last vector, all the non-zero terms are multiplied by xn minus 1. So I can pull out those scalar factors. And now what you see is effectively I have a hyperplane. What's a hyperplane? A hyperplane is a set of vectors that we form by picking a starting point and then allowing ourselves to depart from that starting point in a fixed set of directions by arbitrary distances. Look up here. Here's a constant vector. And it's just sitting there. And then I'm adding to it a free parameter times a particular vector. And I'll have a free parameter times the second vector. I'll have a free parameter xn minus 1 times a particular vector. So what I've displayed here is the presentation of the solution of that linear equation, not by solving for a particular variable, rather I'm choosing to display my solution at point on a hyperplane. And in fact, this is the way we'll proceed in this course. When we solve linear equations, we won't be looking so much for the values of individual variables. Rather, we'll try to specify can capture all the solutions as living on a particular hyperplane. All right, so that's how we'll deal with solution sets of linear equations. What I want to do now is actually give you some explicit examples of what this looks like in three-dimensional space where we should all be able to visualize fairly easily what's going on. So ignore these equations. I'm just wrote these down so I can refer to them in the slides. But let me show you what happens when you have a single equation and three variables. Now, if you feed this into a mathematics software program that can graph solutions of equations, well, this is what you get. Now, don't be, I'm using Maple to actually produce this thing. And what Maple does is it chooses a box in the three-dimensional space, and then it shows you the points inside that box that satisfy the given equation. So here you can see the three-dimensional box. And what I hope you can see from this is that the infinite plane that's contained, well, the part of the infinite plane that corresponds to the solution set that's contained inside this square box is exactly this green shaded area. What is it? Maybe not so clear in the on screen here, but what I mean is it's an infinite plane spread off flat. The infinity just like a line, it's infinite. And software is only capturing the part that actually intersects a particular cube. But hopefully, it's depicted in such a way that you can visualize this as a flat two-dimensional surface embedded in a three-dimensional space. In fact, what is plotted here is exactly the solution set of this equation. Okay, so that's a single equation in three variables. What happened? We had a single equation imposed on three variables. Our solution set had dimension two. That's going to be typical. Every time you would impose an equation, you put more restrictions on your variables, and the size of the solution set is going to get smaller. Those jumps in dimension, when you start imposing more equations, that's what I'm seeking to talk about today. But there are going to be caveats to this statement, but generally speaking, if you have three equations and four unknowns, your solution set is going to be the number of variables you have minus the number of equations you've imposed, and that will be the dimension of your solution space, usually. But part of the point of today's lecture is to show you when that's not true. But let's stress again what you should expect if you solve, say, a system of n equations and m unknowns, is you should expect the size of your solution set to be equal to the number of variables you started off with minus the number of equations you impose. All right, so here's another second example, but now we have two equations. So let's do cap dimensions. I have three unknowns, two equations, 3 minus 2 is 1. I should expect a one-dimensional solution set. And in fact, what this picture shows graphically is how that one-dimensional solution set arises geometrically. Each equation corresponds to a plane. But to satisfy both equations, you have to live on both planes. And so what we're actually interested in is not the individual planes. To get the solution set of this pair of equations, you want the intersection. And what happens? The intersection of two-dimensional planes is in general a line. And that's another hyperplane, right? A hyperplane is also a geometric object that we can write as L is equal to the starting point plus a single free variable times a particular dimension. That's also of the form of a hyperplane, just that there's only one direction in there. Okay, and indeed, a hyperplane solution is what's brought out by this graphic. All right, so generally speaking, the situation that's depicted on the slide here holds in general. Every time you impose, if I only had a single equation, I'd have a two-dimensional space. Imposing an additional equation chops down that space further. Typically, you drop one dimension in your solution set for each equation. Ah, let's see. But that's not always what happens. So now I come to the important part of the lecture, show you the caveats to this. Alright. Well, here what I have plotted is both the solution set of x plus y plus b is equal to 2 and the solution set of 2x plus 2y plus 2z is equal to 4. Two different equations. Yeah, when you actually feed these equations into a software program and have them graph the solution, you only get one plane. I have three variables, two equations. How come I'm not getting a one-dimensional solution set? 3 minus 2 should equal 1. Well, what's happening here is that these two equations have the same solution. So if this equation is true, and then I impose this equation, I'm not putting a new restriction on my variable. It's already implicit in this. Notice that the second equation is just 2 times the first equation. And when you multiply an equation by a number, multiply both sides by the same number, you don't change the solution. Okay, so it is not true that if you have 4 equations and 4 unknowns, you always have a zero-dimensional solution. 4 minus 4 would equal 0. So what could happen is that some of the equations could be redundant. Some of the equations could be implied by equations that preceded it, in which case the imposition of the new equation would not put a new restriction on the variables, and so it would not reduce the solution set. Okay, now, what I want to warn you about in this particular example, it's easy to see that this equation has the same solution set as this. After all, I just have to take this equation, divide by 2, and I recover the original equation. What's subtle and difficult in this course is that when I have 10 equations, 18 unknowns, there may very well be redundancies amongst those equations, but they're not going to be this obvious. Yet, you may want to know what the size of the solution set is. And so one of the principal things that we try to do in this course is tell you how to take a set of equations and throw out all the redundancies so you're really working with independent equations. All right, so let's do one more example. Let's see. Oh, there's another thing that can happen. Here I have 2 equations and 3 unknowns. And in this case, the solution planes do not intersect at all. If that's the case, then there's going to be no common solution to both equations. Every solution of this lies on this plane, every solution of this lies on this plane, so these two planes don't have common points. Well, how did that happen? Well, you cannot have x plus y plus b equal 2 and simultaneously have x plus y plus b equal minus 1, because this equation combined with this equation would tell you that 2 is equal to minus 1, right? Just the transitive property of equality. A is equal to B, if B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. Well, 2 is not equal to minus 1. And so we get a contradiction. Okay, so what I'm warning you about here is that when we look at large systems equations, it's not necessarily true that you get the solution, where you get the size of the solution space simply subtracting the number of equations from the number of nodes. You can have redundant equations that are going to destroy that formula. Or even worse, hidden in your set of equations, there may be hidden contradictions that will prevent you from finding any solution to the equation. We're going to be concerned with identifying, for a given system of equations, are there redundancies, are there contradictions? And as long as we can satisfy ourselves that we have neither contradictions or redundancies, then that basic rule is going to follow. To get the size of the solution set, you just subtract the number of equations from the number of variables. In addition, the solution set, if you have, there are always going to be hyperplane type constructions. Starting with a single point, and your solution set is then going to be formed by starting at a particular point and then going arbitrary distances along a fixed set of directions. All right, so let's see. So here's what we got so far. We have two equations and three unknowns. What usually happens is those equations are not contradictory, not redundant, and the addition of the solution set is actually going to be the intersection of two planes, which will be a line. But it's also possible that if the second equation is already implied by the first equation, that you could get redundant equations, and you're, in this case, your intersection is still a plane, but the intersection of two solution sets, they actually coincide with one another. Or you can be in this situation where you have contradictory equations, and then what happens is you have planes that don't intersect. Let's look at, so that's what happens in general. All right, so let's do one more example. Now we'll consider three equations and three unknowns. And that here's the general picture of what's going to happen in general. Three equations, each is going to be represented by a two-dimensional flat surface embedded in your three-dimensional space of Earth. And to satisfy all three equations, you're going to have to live and on all three of these planes. And in fact, what usually happens, it's hard to tell from that graphic, and maybe it's going to be hard to tell on the blackboard as well, because they don't really have any flat surfaces here. But generally speaking, so let the blackboard be one two-dimensional surface. When I intersect it with another flat two-dimensional surface, it's going to intersect along the line. And if I have a third one, well, it's going to intersect at a single point. And so that rule that independent equations chop down the dimension one dimension at a time, that's still true. But now, three independent equations and three unknowns, we chop down the size of the solution set to a space of dimension 3 minus 3, a zero-dimensional space, which is not empty. When we talk about zero-dimensional spaces, what we're really talking about are single points. Because we just have no degrees of freedom to depart from that point, but it's still a single vector. All right, so this is what happens in the generic case. You know, I give you an arbitrary set of three equations and three unknowns, you should expect the solution is probably just a single point. But other things can happen. Here are three equations, and the planes that they're intersecting, they're forming sort of a star. I'll try to indicate this on the blackboard. So here's one equation would be the blackboard, another equation, another button. They can intersect along the line. So how did that count occur? Well, there was actually a hidden redundancy amongst these equations. It's not obvious, is it? But it is kind of obvious, I think, if you simply add the first two equations, x plus y plus b plus minus 1, add that to this, x plus, zero doesn't occur here, x, y plus y equals 2y, b minus b equals 0z, or simply 0, and minus 1 plus minus 1 is equal to minus 2. So in fact, these two equations imply the third equation. But that redundancy is sort of hidden, and that's the phenomenon we're trying to get our handle on. All right, and then you can have contradictory equations. Here, the contradiction, well, I guess it is kind of obvious because the first two equations are definitely contradictory. But in general, you can have three equations in which, here's a better example. I could have an equation corresponding to the blackboard, another equation that intersects like this. So but let me do it this way. So you see that you have this triangle. How am I doing this? What I'm trying to depict are three planes that don't intersect all at once. So you can have a plane that goes there, and then a plane that goes there. So now think of these coming out of the blackboard. out that way, out this way, out that way. They were three separate planes, but they would have no point that's common to all three. You could get points that are common to two of the surfaces, but not all three. Okay, so as we begin to solve linear equations, we're going to pay attention to whether or not they're redundant equations or whether or not they're contradictions among the equations. So I guess I'll finish today's lecture by just summarizing the situation in general. If you have a large system of equations, say n linear equations in n unknown, then the solution set is in general a hyperplane that you create by, now it's going to be some hyperplane in your space of variables, and its dimension is going to be the number of variables you have minus the number of equations. That's if all the equations are independent and non-contradictory. However, if there's some redundant equation, that's going to mean that your solution set is not always chopped down by one dimension by the imposition of an additional equation. And so your solution set is actually going to be larger than what you would naively expect from this calculation. Or, if your equations contain contradictions, then you can end up with an empty set. No solutions at all. Okay, well, that's a good place to stop. At least we hopefully have established intuition for what the solutions are going to look like. What we'll do on Wednesday is we'll actually begin solving equations using a matrix.